The Supreme Court ruled today that the Department of Justice overstepped its bounds with an obstruction charge used to prosecute hundreds of accused rioters in the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Erica Brown has more on what this means for some of the defendants and former President Trump.
In a 6-3 ruling, the Supreme Court made it harder to charge defendants in the Capitol riot with obstruction.
What the majority is saying here is it can't just be walking in and engaging in a riot. It has to be tied to some sort of document destruction.
Conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett issued a stinging and somewhat surprising dissent.
She says, or otherwise means you tried to corruptly impede a official proceeding, and a riot is enough to do that.
Former Harrisburg, Pennsylvania police officer Joseph Fisher brought the case, his lawyer arguing federal prosecutors were using the Enron-era law as a dragnet. The top House Republican voiced approval of the ruling.
Effectively, the court agrees that a number of the defendants in the January 6th proceedings have been overcharged.
The impact is already being felt on the D.C. docket, with more cases being ordered for review and deadlines as soon as next week.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. Well, we have day two today with John Eastman. Of course, John is a constitutional scholar. He was President Trump's attorney, but his resume was, of course, a big one before President Trump ever hired him, else he wouldn't have done that. John, in his studies, clerked with Clarence Thomas. He was the dean of the law school at Chapman University. He used to be an officer at the Federalist Society. All of these things went by the wayside when John chose to represent President Trump and declare that the 2020 election had been stolen from President Trump. That was his downfall. But, of course, he's alive and well, and he joins us frequently because things are happening that are changing. And the decision by the Supreme Court last Friday, as I'm talking to you, where the Supreme Court said, no, you cannot, Justice Department, use that felony charge against J6ers. It is inappropriate. You cannot. And so John joined us to talk about that. We're going to discuss that next. Plus, we're going to talk about an update on what's happening in John's own personal career, whether they've succeeded in taking his law license away from him in California, in the D.C. Circuit, and what's happening to the lawsuits against him in Arizona and Georgia. It's all fascinating stuff, and that will be our discussion today. There was a girl named Alyssa, and she wanted to confirm her pregnancy, so she went in for an ultrasound at a preborn network clinic while her boyfriend Damien waited outside. They were planning a trip to Louisiana for an out-of-state abortion when they found the clinic, which was just across the street from Alyssa's college in Houston. Miraculously, they noticed the building for the very first time. Alyssa was astonished and deeply moved when the ultrasound revealed beautiful, identical twins. She called Damien, "Come inside, now!" Although he was reluctant, Damien eventually confronted the truth he just couldn't deny. Faced with his baby's lives right in front of him, he wept. Alyssa, Damien, and the ultrasound technician watched in amazement as the twins interacted with each other, already closely bonded. Despite being early in her pregnancy, Alyssa's little babies were full of personality and sucking each other's toes. The two strong parents were so moved by this powerful encounter that they decided to cancel their trip to Louisiana. Okay, you see what preborn does? Do you see why I love their ministry? Do you see why I ask you to help them? Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy and make your most generous donation. Well, you're listening to Sandy Rios of Sandy Rios 24/7. You can call us anytime at 662-821-2040. You can write us at sandy@afr.net. You can go on sandyrios.com and find the podcast easily. But, of course, any podcast platform has the show. But you can also go to afr.net. That's home base, and that's where many of you go to listen every single day. Please tell your friends, neighbors and friends about the show. That's how the word gets out, because when you're not on a broadcast signal, people don't stumble across you as much. And so it would be great to have your help to support the show. If you enjoy it, then share it with your friends. All right, so I think that's everything. So sit back and relax if you can, and actually pull out a whistle or two or put on your hat, because it was a great victory, that decision by the Supreme Court this past Friday, to help our friends, the J6ers, on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice. Not social justice, but God's justice. What's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up. Speak up. Say something. Do something. All right, let's go to the Fisher case, because Friday was also a groundbreaking decision, which for those of us that are really vested in a true narrative of January the 6th, and John is certainly one of those, his whole life has been affected by his role on that day, standing next to President Trump as his attorney, encouraging people to sort out the electors and in the Congress, encouraging them to do the right thing because there were states that were objecting and they wanted more time, encouraging Vice President Pence to do what he was constitutionally allowed to do. We know that now because the Congress rushed to pass the statute that a vice president can no longer do that. But he had the power and he refused to use it. I will say it that way. And so that's part of why we got in this mess. So these January 6ers have been... People are so... I hope you're not tired of hearing me say this. I'm saying to my audience. But these guys are still in prison. I think of one kid who's been there for 3.5 years, pre-trial detention. And it makes me sick. It makes me sick what's happening to John. And so what happened on Friday with the Supreme Court decision, which John already touched on, we felt the ground move again. And maybe I don't want to overstate, so I need to know from you, John, how important that decision was. Another 6-3 decision. And it was people to use the felony charge, 18 U.S.C. 1512 C2, against these J6ers. Can you go back, please, and just kind of briefly restate what that was about?
Sure. And let me go back even a little bit further. And this original statute, as I mentioned, was the mob witness intimidation statute. If the federal government had turned, let's say, the mob's driver and turned state's evidence against the mob, and there was going to be a big criminal prosecution, and the mob killed the witness, then that adds on a 30-year sentence. If they just threatened to kill the witness or the family members of the witness, it adds a 20-year sentence. So that's the original statute. I call it the mob witness intimidation statute, and it's a very serious felony. After the Enron scandal, when Arthur Anderson allegedly destroyed thousands and thousands and thousands of documents in order to avoid any criminal prosecution of it or its client, Enron, Congress added a subsection C to that statute that prohibits the destruction of documents in order to obstruct justice or to prevent criminal prosecution. And then subsection C2 says, or otherwise obstructs an official proceeding. And it's clearly designed to kind of close the gap that documents, records, emails or whatever, if I miss something or otherwise obstruct. But instead, the Department of Justice took that otherwise language and basically used it as a standalone criminal provision that if you do anything to get in the way of any official government proceeding, then that's a 20-year felony. Think about the women who stood up and obstructed the confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh for about 15 uh-huh. minutes. Under the Department of Justice's interpretation of this statute, that was a 20-year felony. Think about the protesters up in Portland who shut down the federal courthouse when they made the Chaz, no government zone. That clearly was an obstruction of all sorts of official proceedings because the court couldn't meet. Now, that's 20-year felony. That's not just a misdemeanor trespass. And so the Department of Justice was using, a creative interpretation, broad interpretation of this provision to go after and bring the hammer down on the J6 people who, by and large, committed misdemeanor trespass at worst, to make it a 20-year felony and therefore pressure people to take pleas, even if the police had invited them in. as we now know, happened in many of these cases. So it was an extraordinarily distorted version of the statute that the Department of Justice was using, basically to send a political message. You cross the government, you do things we don't like, you raise questions about the election, you raise questions about transgendered men going into your girls' locker rooms, you raise questions about CRT in your public schools, then by God, we're going to go after you with everything we've got. This was the message designed to keep the American people acting like sheep. And what the Supreme Court did on Friday and said no go is an extremely important decision, both for the criminal law, but also for our First Amendment rights to protest when we see the government doing something untoward and acting illegally.
I want to read this story just for a second. This is from Julie Kelly, our friend Julie. She tells the story of Joseph Fisher. It's a simple, it's not the detailed story, but this Joe Fisher was a policeman, former, from Pennsylvania, who attended Trump's speech, later went to the Capitol, and according to court documents, Fisher briefly entered the building around 3:25, nearly an hour after the joint session of Congress to certify the Electoral College votes had recessed. He exited about 4 minutes later. And on March of 2021, a D.C. grand jury indicted Fisher on numerous counts, including 1512C2. And so that I think that this, they probably picked the best case in the world, really, to challenge this. It sounds like Joseph Fisher did nothing, John, unless there's more to the story that I don't know. It sounds like he did nothing.
He like many of the other people. Look, I mean, what we know now is that the first people on the scene, maybe FBI plants, maybe agitators, removed the barriers outside of the Capitol that warned people that what was normally public space was now secured a security zone. They removed those barriers and hid the signs so that people even walking onto the grounds were committing trespass. And then going into the Capitol, we've seen the videos of the infamous tunnel. But that was not what occurred in most of the entrances around the Capitol. Police were opening the doors. They were escorting them through. Nobody had any idea that what they were doing was illegal. But at most, it was a misdemeanor trespass. And they're putting on this 1512 suit action. Well, you were there to obstruct the official proceeding, and therefore 20 years behind bars, throw away the key. This was an abuse of our criminal law, and it was designed, like I said earlier, to shut people up from talking about the obvious illegality in the election that we all saw with our own eyes.
We did see it with our own eyes. But it's amazing how blinded, how quickly congressmen were turned. I always say they were in the building and they didn't see what we saw. And they were frightened. And so they only knew what the media fed them. And I think that's part of why they responded so badly and so quickly to judge and to condemn the people that were there actually to encourage them to do the right thing. And some of the congressmen were getting ready to do the right thing. And it completely thwarted what might have brought a different result for that election. You know, my understanding is, John, that Matthew Graves and Merrick Garland have signaled, and in fact in writing, I've seen this in an article, that they're looking now. They said 2 weeks ago, I read that they were looking for ways to add time to the sentences of the J6ers, and basically bragging that if this was overturned, they would make these guys and women, if there are any of them that have this charge, serve their sentences, what their different charges, concurrently and not or separately, whatever the term is, consecutively.
Consecutively, yeah.
So no, and so that they would end up with the same sentences as the 20 years. Can that be done, really?
Well, not after the fact. They're not going to be able to go back and try and add to sentences that have already been imposed after one sentence is dropped. But at some point, we have got to start looking at this as selective prosecution as well. And I'm going to encourage your readers. There's an important decision about 2 months ago out of one of the federal courts in California by Judge Carmack Carney. This involved the protest, and one side, the conservative political side of the protest, was criminally prosecuted to the full scope of the law, and the other side of the equally or worse violence in the protest was let off the hook. And he said this kind of selective prosecution obviously implicates equal protection, but First Amendment rights. When we're going after one side of a political dispute by throwing the book at them and leaving the other side relatively unscathed, that's a violation of equal protection, but it also is designed to send a message to chill your speech and to chill your protest and to chill your right to petition the government for redress of grievances. If you come at these things from the side of the political spectrum that the current government doesn't approve, that is one of the most dangerous threats to our Constitution we've seen. And these kind of selective prosecutions and those kind of statements out of the Department of Justice and the top of the Department of Justice, the Attorney General himself, saying we're gonna find a way around this Supreme Court decision to hold these people accountable because we don't like their speech, we don't like their message, we don't like their movement, because it's an anti-government movement. It's in a movement that seeks to keep the government within its constitutionally assigned roles. This is the greatest danger to our Republican form of government that I've seen in my lifetime. And so far, they've been getting off with impunity on it. And that's why this next election is so important, because if we don't push back against this abuse of our criminal law that we are witnessing, then we will forever become sheep or stand up to it and become imprisoned. That's the choices that we have if we don't get this fixed right now.
Well, don't you think these decisions are a good start?
I think they're an extremely important good start. Without these decisions, things would just be locked into place and we wouldn't have much of a prospect. But they are only a start, because the lower courts, like Merrick Garland has already demonstrated with the Fisher decision, they're going to try and find ways around it. And I strongly suspect the lower courts in the District of Columbia are going to take Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, and instead of looking at the overall tenor of the opinion and saying, he's immune, they're going to say, well, this action, they weren't any of his official duties. They're going to put a big thumb on the scale of being on that side of the line. And, by the time that decision comes out, we'll be a year down the road. And hopefully the Supreme Court will take it up again and say, no, that's not what we said. You're completely distorting that decision. This was exercising the power to take care of the laws we faithfully executed. He's immune, absolutely immune. That's what the decisions in the lower courts ought to be if they're faithfully applying the law. But what we see at the Department of Justice is ways to get around the law. Look at Joe Biden's student loan forgiveness plan, struck down by the court overwhelmingly, and then instead of complying with the Supreme Court decision, they spend time trying to figure out, is there a way we can avoid that decision? Is there a way we can cleverly get around it and do what we wanted to do anyway? That's not the rule of law. That's the rule of absolute will, thumbing your nose at the rule of law, and we see it happen over and over and over again. And it's got to stop.
It has to stop. I just think sometimes there has to be a line drawn in the sand, and it seems like the Supreme Court has done that, at least in part here. I want to ask you about a couple of justices. It's just ironic to me that the decision today, as we're speaking on Monday, July the 1st, the presidential immunity case, that John Roberts, who we've been very disappointed in the last several years, wrote the opinion. And as you have said, I'll take it from you, that it was a great opinion. Now, the Fisher case on Friday, one of the dissenters was Amy Coney Barrett. Well, can you say anything about that dissent from her, and did that surprise you?
Well, it did surprise me. I had predicted months ago that Fisher would come out 6-3, maybe even 7-2. But so it came out 6-3. But I did not predict that Ketanji Brown Jackson would be in the majority and then Amy Coney Barrett would be in the dissent. I've not yet had a chance to read Justice Barrett's dissent to kind of grapple with why she ended up there. My intuition is that she's like her former boss and mentor, Justice Antonin Scalia, a very, very strident textualist. But the problem, and you know, if you read the 1512 subsection C2 statute, stand alone, otherwise obstruct an official proceeding, it would seem to cover the conduct here. But to do that, you've got to read it out of context. You've got to read it out of constitutional background. Like, that would mean anybody that protests any government action exercises their right to petition the government for redress of grievances would be in violation of that 20-year felony statute. That cannot possibly be the right reading. It takes it all out of all context, out of the context of the other provisions of the statute. It's what I call a hypertextualist reading. And we don't typically go with hypertextualism in order to get to original meaning. We look at common sense understanding of the text in the context. Without reading her dissent, I suspect that's probably what she's doing. I would caution her against that in future cases, because that's just not the way text or statutes are put together. We gotta look at these things with a little bit of a realistic eye about what the thing means.
It is so strange, and I'm sure you're not prepared to comment on this, but I didn't say, and I'm glad you did, that Ketanji Brown Jackson was one of the majority in the court that decided that on the J6 felony application. It's amazing. To your point about the judges, especially in D.C., Julie Kelly has pointed out that there's only one judge on that D.C. circuit who dismissed that charge, and that's how the Joseph Fisher case went up to the Supreme Court. The 18 others who are, you know, and I'm going to, maybe I can't read them all. I think some of them are more. Let me read just a few of them. There's Judge Beryl Howell. He was a former chief judge appointed by Obama. Judge Rudolph Contreras, didn't his name come up in the FISA court? I think. Appointed by Obama. There's Judge John Bates, who's appointed by George W. Bush. Amit Mehta, appointed by Obama. I'm trying to. Judge Royce Lamberth, who's made some really great decisions in the past, has been terrible on this stuff. He was appointed by Reagan. And let's see, there's Amy Berman Jackson, appointed by Obama. There's a Trump appointee, Timothy Kelly, several Clinton appointees. They've all been terrible on this, John. I know you're an attorney and you have to be careful about your words, but what do you think is going on there? These guys are supposed to be the creme de la creme to make it to the D.C. Circuit. How could they rule so off the mark on that particular statute being applied to the J6ers?
Well, and hats off to Judge Carl Nichols, who was the one judge that got it right. I've come to the view that this Trump derangement syndrome is a real thing, and people get blinders on for anything that involves Trump or involves people in Trump's circle. They get blinders on. Look, I mean, none of these cases should even still be in the District of Columbia. There is no more powerful ground for a change of venue than we've ever seen in history than a change of venue of these cases. And yet none of the judges were granting motions for change of venue. They wanted them. There was intensely political. It's become intensely partisan. Our courts are supposed to be insulated from that. But we have to be a little bit realistic here, that when the intensity of the partisan divide has reached the level it has, we shouldn't expect that judges are immune from that natural human condition. We hope they are. We give them the tools of life tenure and other things to help insulate them. But at the end of the day, those are just tools to get them to do what they're supposed to do. And they don't always work.
You know, I saw, you probably did too, speaking of that, of having the venue be in D.C., which is what those J6ers, so many of them have begged to have their trials moved out of D.C., and the Justice Department refuses because they love this. And in fact, they're still, as you know, John, they're arresting more people every day. They have a goal, I've forgotten exactly, but maybe 1,000 a day. It's ridiculous. They have a goal to arrest hundreds more people for the January 6th situation. Maybe this ruling will slow them down. But one thing that stood out to me, Ashley Babbitt, of course, was the woman shot by the Capitol Police officer, and many people think that was a wrongful death. I'm one of them. I don't know if you call it murder, but it certainly was. He was out of line. That situation did not call for him shooting her the way he did and killing her. Her mom is in D.C. almost every night. She's at the D.C. jail. Her mom's name is Mickey. And she's trying to, you know, intercede, do what she can. She's not a wealthy person. She just loves her daughter, and she's been there every night with prayer vigils. And so now they've brought a lawsuit of some sort. And I just read that the Justice Department has refused to let this case be tried in California, which is, I believe, their home state, and is insisting now to move it to D.C. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that or comments, but it's an example of the injustice, the unfairness that's happening to just plain people.
Well, it is, and it's also an indication that our system of justice requires one of the most fundamental aspects of due process. It requires a neutral decision maker. And when you get intensely partisan cases that are fueled by intensely partisan narrative coming out of the government, coming out of the corporate propaganda media, I call them, the ability to get a fair trial in intensely partisan jurisdictions is diminished to almost zero. That's the reason why they want to keep these in the District of Columbia, where 90 or 95% of the people voted for Joe Biden and against President Trump. The deck is already stacked. It's the same thing that went on in the business records case up in New York that's led to President Trump's conviction and potential jail sentence beginning on July 11th. Preposterous. But Manhattan is an intensely partisan jurisdiction. And so,
absolutely,
you can't expect a fairness in jurisdiction like that, which is why we have change of venue rules to get into a more neutral territory so that people are looking at the evidence rather than looking at it through the lens of their partisan bias.
Well, just as an aside, you know, Merrick Garland has been found in contempt by the Congress because he won't turn over the tape you mentioned. He's refusing to comply with that subpoena. And now the next thing would be something legal to happen to him. And I don't think any judge is going to do that, given that the Justice Department is so powerful. And so there's a move in Congress right now to they're invoking something that's been used like 100 years ago. I forgot, inherent contempt, something like that. And that means that the Congress could go and arrest him. So this is going to be very interesting to see if our Congress actually finds their man parts and girl parts, I guess, to do. It's a woman who's bringing it up. It's the Congresswoman from Florida, who's Anna Paulina Luna. So now, let's turn our attention, John, to your own situation, if we could. And I might just say to those of you listening, John has been our guest many times through the past few years. We've tracked what's happening with him. He's lost his legal license in California, very painful procedure, and we can recap that a little bit. And now they want to take his license from him in D.C. He's lost positions, and this is all because he represented Donald Trump and all because he gave this opinion to President Trump and to Vice President Pence that he did not have to carry on with accepting the electors as they were because of the disputes in the states. And because of that, he's fallen into this massive, entangled mess of trying to get at people that supported Donald Trump. So that's just the best way I can explain it. So, John, can you kind of give a capsule review of what happened with your law license? Then let's move to D.C. because I know they are trying to take it away from you there also.
Sure. So, yeah, I've become the poster child for lawfare, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
That's good. That's good.
After the 10-week-long, longest and most expensive bar disciplinary proceeding in history, we believe, the bar court in California recommended that I be disbarred because, you know, I said there were things wrong with the election and the government said otherwise, and therefore I was lying and beyond that exhibiting moral turpitude. Now, the bar court doesn't have authority to actually take my license away. It's only a recommendation. Only the California Supreme Court can do that. And we've got two steps to get there on appeal, and we are vigorously contesting it on appeal. But in the interim, I've been placed on inactive enrollment in California, and the District of Columbia said, well, if you're inactive enrollment there, we'll do the same thing, pending final resolution. Interestingly, the U.S. Supreme Court, which also was notified of the action in California, didn't see it as a disbarment, because it's not. And they said, yeah, just keep us apprised. And in the meantime, I still continue to practice in the U.S. Supreme Court. This is how we're going. I've also been indicted in Georgia and in Arizona. 2 weeks ago, we filed a very important, first of its kind, anti-SLAPP motion in Arizona. Arizona is the only state in the country that has added criminal prosecutions to its anti-SLAPP statute. And SLAPP means strategic litigation against public participation. Their anti-SLAPP statutes are designed essentially to prevent, say, a developer from suing people complaining about their project in order to silence them. And you get to bring an anti-SLAPP motion on the front end of the case. If they can't prove you violated the law on the front end, the case gets dismissed, and they have to pick up your attorney's fees. Arizona added criminal prosecutions to this about almost 2 years ago, and ours is the first one to bring an anti-SLAPP motion in a criminal context. We said, look, everything we did was protected by the First Amendment, free speech, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. And we had a whole lot of grievances about that conduct at that election and the steps necessary to hear those things out. And so all of this is constitutionally protected activity. The attorney general of the state campaigned on going after so-called election deniers and prosecuting them. That indicates that she was doing this as retribution for their ongoing exercise of constitutional rights. And that meets the standard to have the case dismissed. We'll see whether the courts in Arizona faithfully apply that new law and dismiss these charges. But that's where the fight is right now.
Okay. Now, on Arizona before we leave it, you actually were not involved. They had a really strong voter integrity project early on. They didn't call it that. But I sat through those hours of testimony from people in Arizona about what they'd seen in the 2020 election. And I was so compelled by that, John. They were really fine, intelligent people from all walks of life, different people. I think there was even a doctor. There were different people, teachers, people that were involved in the election process who saw so many bad things happening. Arizona's been very serious about rooting out the problem, but they've gotten such serious opposition. I don't know if you probably shouldn't speak to the political situation there, but I don't even know. I can't tell from here if they'd made progress or not. It seems like once they have a breakthrough, then they have a huge setback because there's just a lot of corruption there right now. You can say something or not. I don't want to get you in trouble.
Yeah, no, look, it's a problem. And people say, well, it was a Republican legislature. And I'll remind people, I say, the Republican Party is divided, as are the Democrats, although we are a little bit more honest about our divide. There were Republicans that supported Trump, and there were Republicans that were virulently anti-Trump. And if you've got a legislature that's, say, a 5-vote margin of Republicans, but 7 of them are virulently anti-Trump, that's not a Republican legislature on these issues. It's a Democrat legislature. And so you've got to peel a layer off of the onion in order to really see what's going on. But the second thing is, yeah, those hearings, they were stunning about the illegalities that had occurred in the election and illegalities that have been subsequently recognized in court decisions way too long after the fact to have done any good about, the number of ballots not actually that were sent over to the processing center not being the same that were sent back. That means somebody injected ballots into the system, and they've now admitted that. Signature verification illegally done, not in accordance with the statutory requirements. They've now demonstrated that in a court of law. So we've got these issues that were raised. Here's my bigger concern. The issues that were raised at the time were being discounted or so-called debunked by election officials. And we are just supposed to accept what they've told us as gospel truth, even if it's blatantly false on the front end. Like things like, this was the most secure election in history. That was laughable, right? I mean, yes. So we really have entered Orwell's world of 1984, 40 years late, but we've entered it. The government says a blatant lie, and you're not only expected to repeat the lie, but you have to come to believe the lie, or you will be criminally prosecuted by people that come out from the Ministry of Love to teach you what you really ought to be thinking. That's just where we are, and that's why I'm pushing back as hard as I am, and I know why you and your audience are pushing back as hard as you can, because we've got something at stake here that is more precious than any individual conduct that we have. We've got something that we want to pass on to our kids and grandkids, and that's called freedom. It's called the freedom of conscience, the freedom to speak, the freedom to criticize your government. And I'll close with this piece here. You know, the old English used to have a law called the law of seditious libel. If you criticize the government, you could be criminally prosecuted. And truth was not a defense, because the greater the truth, the greater the libel. If what you were saying about the government was actually true, it brought them into more disrepute and therefore undermined them even further. And that's what we're criminally prosecuting you for. Our First Amendment was written in large part to repudiate that old English law of seditious libel. And yet we have readopted it in full force and vigor in this modern dispute. And it's worth protecting the First Amendment as originally conceived to push back against this with everything we've got.
I totally agree, John. And for that, you are a champion for sure. And we've had conversations, and I say again, I admire you so much. Pray for your family, and you inspire us. And for that, we really thank you. And I actually think, you know, because of your steadfastness and people like Steve Bannon and others who just will not bend, they will not break. The thing that I love about you, I love it when you're being persecuted by in one of these venues and the reporters are hating on you and they say, do you still believe the 22 election was stolen? And you go, yes, and then you lay it out there just so calmly, unflappable. It kind of reminds me of Martin Luther on trial by the worms, diet of worms, what it was called, worms in Germany. And they pinned him down. He thought he was going to be killed. And he basically said, I can do no more. Here I stand. You know, I said it. It's the truth. Here I stand. And I kind of think of you when I think of that, John.
Let's do a test. I want to see how engaged your audience is. Ask people to go to my Legal Defense Fund site, givesendgo.com/Eastman, and make a donation of any amount ending in 7. So we'll see how many Sandy Rios audience members make donations in the next 48 hours.
Oh, okay.
Ending
all right,
in
wait.
7.
Okay, wait a second. Givesendgo.com/, say it again.
Givesendgo.com/Eastman. And make a donation. I think the minimum is $5. So you can do $7 or $17 or $57 or $507, whatever you want. Just end it in 7, and we'll see what kind of reach Sandy Rios' audience has.
I think that you have a future in marketing, John. If the things don't work out in the law, I think you should be going to marketing. Anyway, okay, that's a great idea. We'll do givesendgo.com/Eastman. And you have to give a gift, you know, of $7 or something ending in 7. At least we're inviting you to do that so that you can show that you really do support John. All kidding aside, I know that you do support him. And so it would be wonderful to show that by giving him, because the bills are enormous and he's had to move and his whole family has been disrupted. So, all right, John Eastman, thank you, sir. Go forth and do something important. And we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thank you, Sandy. All right,
okay.
Take care.
All right. God bless you. Okay, bye-bye. This is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Abortions performed by Planned Parenthood were among the top leading causes of death in America, revealing the terrifying truth of the left's anti-life agenda. According to Planned Parenthood's 2022-23 annual report, abortions performed by the organization accounted for the top 4 leading causes of death. Think about that. Paid for by our tax dollars. And honestly, this freight train is going down the track so fast and so powerfully. It's really hard. It's going to be hard for us to stop this. And I think one of the best ways, I've said before, I'll say again, is preborn. Preborn, who is not part of the government, not part of the public debate or campaigns, but an organization that's simply providing ultrasounds for moms who are pregnant and doubting whether they should carry the baby to allow them to see their baby through ultrasound. It's an amazing process, and it actually works. When the moms see their babies, I think it doubles the chance that they will not take the life of their baby. You know, you can't beat those odds. If you'd like to help, $28 pays for one ultrasound, just one. And you can send however much you can afford. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Hi, this is Sandy Rios. A lot of Christians would be shocked to learn they are personally profiting from abortion and pornography. It's unnerving to realize just how many companies and corporations are actively involved in unbiblical practices. To help cut through the red tape, there is a great option known as Timothy Plan. Timothy Plan is the pioneer in biblically responsible investing. Timothy Plan carefully filters out companies involved in practices Scripture tells us to avoid. We are in an all-out culture war. One powerful way to make a difference is to put our money where our values are. Please go to timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-846-7526. Discover how to be a biblically responsible investor.
Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the investment company. This and other important information can be found in the fund's prospectus. To obtain a copy, visit timothyplan.com or call 800-846-7526. Read each prospectus carefully before investing.
U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland expressed disappointment and pointed out in a statement, the vast majority of the more than 1,400 defendants will not be affected by this decision. There are no cases in which the department charged a January 6th defendant only with the offense at issue in Fisher. The ruling could impact part of former President Trump's federal election case.
I will be shocked if Special Counsel Jack Smith does not have court papers ready to say that he can still charge former President Trump with obstruction, arguing that he was trying to interfere with the counting and the counting of those state electoral votes, which were paper, which were evidence.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. You know they're not going to give up. Of course they're not going to give up. Merrick Garland is disappointed because that was their card. That's how we're going to throw the book, I think the prosecutor said three years ago. We're going to throw the book at these people and a shock and awe, I think is what he said, actually. So I've asked Bruce to join me to talk about this little tidbit. Honey, I know you've been listening, and we've been talking about this for months now. And finally, the Supreme Court has sort of sorted this out, at least from in their opinion. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, here's the thing. If the Justice Department was really doing what they are sworn to do, they would accept this decision, and they would say, okay, we are going to knock out this charge against anyone that's either pled to it, is facing it, or we've even talked to them about possibly being charged with it. But I'm going on past actions. I'm going to guess this is not going to happen. What the Justice Department will do is they will try to recharge people that have not been sentenced already, have not gone to trial yet. They will try to construct another charge against them. If they've already been sentenced, I'm not sure if I agree with Mr. Eastman that their sentence cannot be added to. I'd have to do some research, but I'm not so sure that the government, instead of agreeing to concurrent sentences under different charges, won't seek consecutive sentences. In other words, if you got convicted for the obstruction, but then also parading and trespassing. So they knock out the obstruction, but the other two charges, instead of letting them serve concurrent sentences, they might say, well, we want consecutive sentences now. So instead of doing 6 years, we're going to make you do 9 years or 12 years, depending on how much you were sentenced for the underlying offenses. So I'm just not convinced that this will be the end all for these convictions.
Yeah. Well, I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, because it's a lawless bunch. But God willing, you know, God willing, it'll sort out. I think about that Devin Nunes suggestion that if President Trump is elected, that a new, completely new attorney general and fire all of those Obama appointees. I mean, maybe just clean house at Justice. I know that would be very controversial and complicated because it's the largest. If the FBI is part of Justice and the Justice Department is one of the largest agencies, this gives you an idea of the scope of our federal government. They are everywhere. They're everywhere. And so, and they're all lawyers. So imagine all the lawsuits if you try to let them go. But I think that that's, at least in theory, that was a wonderful idea. Well, I think it's good news for our certainly for Jacob Lange. I think of Jacob. He's been our guest several times. That's one of the charges they brought against him. He's in pretrial detention still. 3.5 years now.
You know what John said about really what 95% of these people that were charged with crimes, at worst, they should have been charged with trespass. And you see the inequity, as he mentioned, the protesters against the Kavanaugh hearing, nothing happened to them.
Yeah. You know, Bruce, what occurred to me, too? Remember how the protesters defamed, defrocked, whatever word you want to use, the Supreme Court building? Was that the Roe versus Wade decision, or was that the Kavanaugh decision? They climbed up the statues, they banged on the doors and cried and wailed. I believe it was the Kavanaugh decision.
Yeah, you talk about obstructing an official proceeding. They're in there having the confirmation hearing of Justice Kavanaugh, and these people are banging on the door. Now, what kind of, you know, I first off, I couldn't believe that was allowed to happen.
I couldn't either. That was just so
But it was,
offensive.
And then the people were not arrested. In fact, how many people did they remove from the gallery for obstructing the proceeding? But then they would go outside, spend about a half an hour, and then they would be allowed right back into the proceeding.
Yes, I remember that, Bruce. It was just disgusting. So we know the Justice Department has not seen justice in a long, long time. And God willing, we can bring justice back. At least today, we have a glimmer of hope, and I'm going to take it. And for those of you who just heard John, you know how I feel about him. I think you will agree. And if you haven't heard John on this show before, go back and search it where whatever podcast platform you look at. You can find out all kinds of interesting things because he has repassed a fount of knowledge. He's got a photographic memory, and he's just amazing. And, you know, his own daughters have spoken out in his defense. His wife is so steadfastly beside him. He's lost so much. He had to sell his house. His family's been threatened so many times, death threats. It's been a nightmare for them. And yet John will not budge. He will not bend. He just continues to tell the truth. So if you want to help him, he'll know that you helped him. He'll know this show helped him. And I just think that would be terrific. It's really a great idea. If you go to givesendgo.com/Eastman and enter your donation with 7, he just was describing. That way he'll know it's coming from this show. Otherwise, it's just a mass of people donating. Probably not a mass right now, but a group of people donating. It's givesandgo.com/Eastman and give your most generous donation ending with a 7. Honey, thank you.
Thank you, honey. Always thank you. This is so important.
Yeah. All right, if you want to call us at 662-821-2040, or you can write us at sandy@afr.net. You can find us on any social media platform, and you could also, of course, go to sandyrios.com and listen to the podcast or any podcast platform that you like or prefer. We want to thank our sponsors. Of course, Timothy is our new sponsor, and they allow you to put your money where your values are and discover how to be a biblically responsible investor. Visit timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy, or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. All right, thanks for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.